Hey there, Freedom Fighters. You know me. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. Recently, I was in Santiago, Chile, where I flew to run a marathon, 26.2 miles. Ryan, a lot of people consider like 3 mile runs a marathon. A marathon actually has to be 26.2 miles. So I did it. And I also flew there to interview entrepreneurs. And in between, you know, first day was interview, last day was run the marathon. In between, I thought, I'm just going to live in a new city for a week and work out of a new city. And man, was I distracted. The internet wasn't exactly doing what I wanted to do. And for some reason, I didn't go to a Regis office. I wanted to, I guess, to experience day-to-day life there. It didn't do it. I got distracted by all the interesting sights, by all the interesting people, by the fact that I wanted to practice my Spanish. I got very little work done. Joining me today, though, is an entrepreneur from Panama right now, where he started his company, and somehow he wasn't distracted by all that. So, or maybe he was. We'll find out. Whether he was or he wasn't, I know this for sure. The guy was able to get some serious work done. And the thing that he worked on was the creation of Humanity. Joining me is the founder of Humanity. His name is Ryan Fife. I can't stop. I love saying it that way, Ryan. The name of his company is Humanity. I don't know why. It's a goofy approach. It's like, I'm sure you've heard it a million times. I still can't get over it. The name of the company is Humanity. He is the founder of Humanity. It is enterprise employee scheduling software. So, you know, you've got to schedule employees. And in the past, it used to be this big piece of paper that was on a wall somewhere and people would have to go and write their names and fill in when they, he said, you know what? Enough of that. I'm going to do this all in the cloud. And he did it and it did great. And then I don't know what happened. He left. He said, that's it. And he moved on to create something called WorkChain. It's real-time payroll using blockchain and cryptocurrency, which, Ryan, like a year ago, everybody would have been in love with you. Crypto, blockchain, the whole thing. And now I wonder how people are treating you now that both of those, blockchain, cryptocurrency, both of those terms are out of favor. We're going to find out about all that thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first will do your email marketing so well. It is the best of the best. Active Campaign. And the second, if you want to hire developers, and Ryan, you're going to want to know about them. You got to know about TopTal. I'll tell everybody about those later. Ryan, good to see you here.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Ryan, what's your revenue at Humanity? I know you're not there day to day, but when you left, let's say, what was the revenue?
Yeah, sure. What I can disclose publicly is that the company is over $10 million in revenue. It's a profitable company today. Like you mentioned, I stepped down from the team about a year ago.
Is it wrong to then look over your shoulder and go, are you living in a hostel? I'm seeing bunk beds with no sheets and tell me.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm right now in the middle of moving. So I'm going to be moving back from Panama to Canada. And so my apartment is a complete mess. And this is my daughter's room. And it was sort of like the only place I could find that still looks somewhat presentable.
Okay.
So after 10 years in here in Panama, I'm going to be heading back to Canada for a while.
Why?
The biggest reason I stayed in Panama was for my daughter. I've got an 8-year-old and she's actually going to be heading up to North America as well, studying. And so for me to be closer to her, it's going to be Canada and the US actually for the while.
So you got to Panama, you had a child and you said, I'm going to stay here, make sure that the child, my daughter, gets the culture and education that she was born into.
Yeah. And it's pretty insane to think about because for, you know, the first few years of her life, I had half custody of her. And so I was, you know, spending 3.5 days a week with her. And it was literally at the same time when the company was, you know, growing very quickly in those early years, we made the decision to go ahead and, do the traditional like Delaware Silicon Valley company. And so I would get on a plane every Sunday night. I would show up in San Francisco Monday through Wednesday, fly home overnight, and then spend sort of that long weekend with my daughter, just kind of complete insanity week after week.
And you could totally be with her because I find that kids know when you're not fully focused and the stress level when you got to pay attention to a kid and the voice in your head that says you need to finish this one project is insane.
So I could, and I don't know if I just got incredibly blessed or if she knew like with the lucky baby that could focus or let me focus or whether she also knew that there was something different about the situation. And I can just point to situations where I'm on like a make or break demo with who's going to become our next biggest customer. I'm still like kind of the lead sales rep. And my daughter would sit in her play crib for literally an hour next to me while I'm pitching the demo.
Wow.
And not cry or say a word. Just look at me happily. Like I've never seen another kid do that. It's just incredible, you know?
That is shocking. Were you married to her mom? Is it too personal to ask you that?
No, it's not. I wasn't. We were separated. So,
okay.
Yeah. So it's been a bumpy but interesting road. Luckily, things have been getting a lot better as my daughter's getting older. And so now we're going to, now finally, when I'm no longer working in the US, now I have the opportunity to get there. So it's a little bit ironic, a little backwards.
What were you doing in Panama City?
Yeah. So I first, before starting Shift Planning, I was doing contract web development and more kind of traditional SEO, doing like made for AdSense websites. So I built a huge network of content websites and then putting up ad space on them. And so I was looking for a place, I was just out of high school. I was looking for a place that had, you know, low cost of living, good tax situation, a language I wanted to learn, beautiful girls that were down here. And so those, I traveled a lot to kind of figure out which countries in the world had all of those places. And Panama was really the only place that I found that sort of hit that sweet spot of, you know, a booming economy at the time. The first time I came here was 15 years ago. And to see the change in the country here is kind of like seeing Dubai on a different scale, of course, but it's just phenomenal how quickly this thing built up.
You know, one of the nice things about traveling somewhere else is you really are living the life that you want. You get to experience a new environment. You get to really feel every little thing, like going out and getting coffee is a new experience that feels alive to do it. But the other thing is you got to be determined to get up and go. There's this, there are people in the US when the economy is bad who still don't have the willingness to get up and go to a different city. You go to a whole other country, another culture, another language. I feel like that's partially a sense of urgency and a sense of, I don't know, that you have to do something with your life. I wonder if that goes back to your childhood. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the Teenage Ninja Turtles t-shirt that you had as a kid. I see the smile. Sure. You know what I'm talking about. What is that?
Yeah, no. I did. And I had the sweatpants. And I think those are some kind of unique parts of our story because I grew up in Canada, in northern Alberta. A very rich part of Canada, but we actually grew up not so wealthy in that area, both for different reasons of my family. We were kind of like on the poor acreage outside of like one of the richest communities in Alberta. And I think that a lot of that really shaped who I was very early on. You know, I was the youngest as well. And so I kind of always wanted to have a little bit more maybe than I would get for my age, or also just what I saw kids that were my age having. And so it's like, you know, if my brother got something, I wanted to have it. He's 2.5 years older than I was. Or our friends that, you know, their parents owned the video game store or something like that. They had all the latest games and we didn't. And so I think a part of that sort of stuck with me a lot, or that absolutely impacted me. And then I think the other big thing, like you mentioned around travel, is I think, yeah, some people have a very strong sense of home. And for me, I don't really have that. And I think it comes from a few reasons. One of them is my family itself is very, very separated where they live. And then we also moved a lot, you know, when we were growing up. So I was born in Ontario, mainly my dad's job. Yeah, my dad was a professor at the university doing mechanical engineering. And so his job moved around a little bit.
And because then, he had to get different jobs as a professor at different universities?
Well, this was actually when they were like, you know, still going through school. So he did his master's in Ontario. Then he did his postdoc in Belgium. So I spent the first few years of my life in Belgium. And then we had the opportunity to go on a sabbatical, which was an incredible experience. When I was 12, I moved to New Zealand for a year.
Wow.
And so these types of things stuck with me. And then you mentioned you're a runner. That's fantastic. I was a competitive athlete all through kind of middle school and high school. So I got to compete with Canada. I got to go around to Europe and different places to run. And so all of that sort of gave me this nonstop travel bug where, yeah.
What is the Teenage Mutant Ninja story?
I think there's a big... Oh, sorry. Like the part with my brother maybe that I mentioned? Or
with your clothes, yeah. I don't want to tell your story, but there's one that I'm kind of teeing up for you. And if it's too confusing, I'll just jump in and say it.
Yeah, maybe do just jump in.
Here's what I heard about you.
Yep.
One day you showed up to school wearing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle sweats. What happened?
They were from one of the other kids in my class, or, you know, from my brother's friends that were like hand-me-downs. And so we had a lot of, you know, secondhand clothes growing up. But I think that that sort of became a part of our identity, or maybe like I mentioned before, especially I think for my older brother, I wasn't old enough at the time where maybe the material things impacted me just yet. But I think there was sort of that loss of innocence, or, you know, thinking through some of that stuff. And when I did get a little bit older, then that's what pushed me to work just, I think, incredibly hard, because I wanted to have the things that my family couldn't provide. And so, you know, my parents made me business cards when I was very young. I've worked in every, you know, different type of part-time job you can imagine. And that's actually where the idea for shift planning or humanity came from.
And before we get into that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the reason that the business cards were entering your life, the reason that this vision of entrepreneurship entered your life seems to me goes back to, I guess it was your dad. He decided, I'm not going to be in the university system anymore. I'm going to go and work for where? And then he had this life-changing experience.
Okay. Yep. So I got to see I've thought a lot about this as well. These are fantastic and fun stuff to think about or reflect on. The other big thing that happened in my life is that's right. My dad, after being a prof in the university system for about 10 years, he went and started a company with his brother, a technology company. And so I got to watch sort of the whole entrepreneurial journey, happen through that. They exited that company in 2005. They sold it to Garmin, the big GPS company. So that was, another sort of thing that happened, of course, as I was growing up as well. And I got to spend and see a lot of that.
I hired a producer from a TV show to give me some coaching on interviews. And when he looked at my transcript, he said, Andrew, do not look for the Batman moment. I go, what the hell is a Batman moment? He goes, that's where Batman's parents die. And as a result, whoever it is who plays Batman, who is that? His alter ego.
Bruce Wayne,
right. That's where Bruce Wayne's parents die. And then as a result, he becomes Batman. You'd look for these one incidents, Andrew, that then change everything. I don't want to do it with you. Tell me if I am reading too much into it, but it feels to me like watching your dad go from a professor who was making not enough money for you to get your own clothes, you had to have hand-me-downs, where I looked at my notes from our producer's conversation with you. You felt excited walking in with the sweats. And then when you found out it was a friend's, it was a bit of a letdown. So you go from that to suddenly a life-changing experience for your dad, and you realize in your head, you know what? This thing actually is available to me. This can change my life. I'm going to create fake business cards with my mom and maybe play business today and someday have a business. Am I reading too much into it?
I would say the idea of doing something on my own came from well before my dad's actual startup. I think that would have helped sort of solidify or help me think about actually formalizing a startup versus doing something different. So I think it was definitely part of the same progression, but the inner part of me, and I can point back through things all through school. You know, why was I trying to graduate super young?
I graduated or skipped, like, two years earlier or something.
Yeah, I skipped 2 years. I graduated super young. I was working at, sometimes I was closing down a kitchen until like 1 or 2 in the morning on nights when I'd have school the next day. Like, why was I doing all of these things even before my dad had that startup? And so I think, but you're right. There was a couple big key things that helped really make the company possible. One of them was absolutely watching my dad and that experience, because it wasn't just my dad. He started that company with my aunt and uncle. I worked there. I got to work there sometimes during the summer. And so I got a lot of experience through that for sure. The other big thing that happened, though, is I got connected with who's now, a fantastic friend of mine and my business mentor. And it was a web development project that I got in to do. And as a part of that experience, he really took me under his wing. He brought me to all of his pitches. He helped, I'd have input on the business plan and all these types of things. And that was, I kind of got like a business degree essentially from him during that time. And then he became one of our first board members in the early days of the forming of my own company. And so I think all of that helped groom me in a big way for this.
So someone who goes out and creates quick websites to put AdSense on it, to make money from Google by SEO in Google, that's someone who's looking for fast money and is willing to just like create, let's just say, quickie sites, but not really good sites. What was
I agree. It was a lot of garbage content, to be honest.
I didn't want to say, because I didn't want to turn you off in the conversation.
So No. You could say for what it is. I think that, made for AdSense and content stuff or SEO back in the day was a lot of that. But I think the beauty of that is it taught me a lot about following Google and all this stuff, which became, one of the primary reasons for humanity to really accelerate in those early years. But what was the kind of moment that switched? I think as search engine marketing was getting harder and harder, I had to teach myself more web development skills, because you can't manage 5 websites. This was 15, 20 years ago. You can't even manage that many blogs. There wasn't Blogger and all these services, right? And so I was building a program to run this network of over 500 content websites. And then that business was doing incredibly well sort of around the time, like when I was thinking about buying down in Panama and things like that. But it also, like, as well as it was doing, it also imploded pretty quickly overnight as, Google's algorithm changed pretty substantially and started to, really catch on to, like, link, all the types of, let's call it gray hat stuff that was happening from that regard. And so then I started thinking about what next to do. And I worked on a ton of projects that were all, somewhat social media based. This was sort of around the time when there was like lots of different kind of niche social networks. And so I was playing around with ideas for, teenagers in Canada or people that really loved music or all these types of things that would become sort of the next sexy Hi5 or MySpace or whatever was big at the time, right? But it was through watching, I think working with my business mentor a little bit, thinking about how many eyeballs, the company I worked on with him was called Quantum Shift, and it was a media platform for, NGOs and bloggers and different things like that. And when I started, we struck out with that business, unfortunately, just because even if we were able to get the thing to, 50,000, 100,000 monthly visits, it still just generates next to nothing in ad revenue. And so that's, I think, was sort of like an eye opener for me that, maybe creating this next big, like what I thought was going to be a next big sexy revenue generating thing, the revenue might not even be there. And then at about the same time, I started, SaaS was very nascent, but I started thinking, ooh, this is fantastic. There's all these unsexy business problems that you get 100 customers and you're all of a sudden making money. And that for me that was when the light bulb went off. I fell in love with SaaS and didn't look back. So.
Was what became Humanity, was that your first SaaS project?
It was, yep. It was founded as Shift Planning, shiftplanning.com, and we rebranded about 2.5 years ago.
I'm on the original version of Shift Planning right now. It looks good. Okay. Essentially, it's what it is right now, right?
Yeah.
The business didn't, you knew from the beginning what it was going to be. It definitely is a better version of what it was, but it's still the same. There's not an unrecognizable path from one to the other. Let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor, and then we're going to jump right in and figure out how you knew even that this was necessary to create. My first sponsor is a company called ActiveCampaign. Ryan, do you know ActiveCampaign, or am I about to introduce you to them?
I don't. You are.
Do you do email marketing, or are you just like an SEO person usually?
I don't do as much email marketing, but I've used tools like Intercom and similar. So,
okay, great. So, I'll open your eyes to this. So, one of the things that you do right now at WorkChain is you've got this product that allows people to get paid. I'm kind of tying in the ad to your story. Yep. Allow people to get paid fast. The example that I saw on your website was you going in, clocking into work, and then showing your phone, waiting. It didn't happen like a second later, but I like that it didn't happen a second later. It looked more realistic. Less than a minute, within a few seconds later, you got paid and you showed us the transaction and all that happening. Now, there are two groups of people who are interested in that. One is employers. They want to know, does this make sense or not? There are another group of people who are employees. They want to know, do I want this? And if I do, how do I even get my boss to do this? Two different groups of people, both watching that same video that I saw. But after that, they start to diverge. One of them might read a blog post that says, how do you tell your boss that you need to have this? Does this make sense for you? How do you pay the bills when you get blockchained? Will my salary go up and down as Bitcoin prices go up and down? The other one has business-related questions, and they're each reading different blog posts on the same website. If you're using ActiveCampaign and they sign up to your email newsletter, you can target them differently. So you don't go into an employee and start saying, you need to put this into your business. This has to go into your business right now. And you alienate them. But instead, you recognize, hey, this is somebody who's been looking at all my videos about how to tell your boss. This is somebody who's been looking at all my blog posts about how to get paid this way. We should be giving them some guides to how to talk to your boss about getting paid with cryptocurrency, how to integrate this in, how to get other employees excited about it. All right. That's the idea behind ActiveCampaign. Yes, people will join your email newsletter, your email marketing, just like every other software. But what they do is allow you to tag people based on what they've clicked on, what they told you about themselves, what they asked for, and what they've done on your website. And of course, I call them an email marketing company, but they do way more than email. You want to do text messaging? Yes. You want to do chat bot messaging? They do all that. So much more, because what they're about is smart, automated, intelligent marketing, not necessarily just email. All right. If you guys want to get started with it, or Ryan, if maybe on the airplane you say, I don't want to work anymore. I need a little bit of a break, but I'm kind of curious intellectually. Here's what you do. You go to activecampaign.com/Mixergy. When you go there, you're going to see that they'll let you try their software for free. Create a fake company, create a real company, experiment, see what you think about it. And what you're going to find is it's way easier to do than you imagined. And if you decide to stick with them, the second month will be free. If you want help, they give you 2 free one-on-one sessions with their people to make sure that it works. And if you're already with a different email marketing company, if you use my link, they will migrate you for free. So here's the link, activecampaign.com/Mixergy. activecampaign.com/MIXERGY. All right. I'm grateful to them for sponsoring. I like that your company name is Humanity, because unlike me, I always have to spell Mixergy, because otherwise people will type in Mix Energy, and you don't have to do that. Humanity. If you don't know how to spell Humanity, look it up. How did you know that this was a necessary product, that this was a problem worth solving?
I think, like I mentioned, it comes back to sort of that. I worked, I cleaned dishes, I washed cars, I worked in retail lots, and kind of everything in between that, you know, fast food and et cetera. And so I think it was that time that, you know, I felt the problems firsthand from an employee, and especially as an athlete, where, you know, I might have a track meet that comes up in a few weeks time, but I've already been scheduled. And it was literally the type of pain as an individual employee that you have to go in, and I had to bike into work at that time. So I'm biking across town just to go into work to try to figure out, you know, who can cover my shifts. And, you know, sometimes it gets so bad where you actually have to pay people. Like, you go through the list, nobody wants to take it because it's like Friday night and maybe there's a band in town or something like that. So you end up paying people to cover your shifts, or you end up taking 2 of their unattractive shifts in return, like all of this type of stuff. And so I saw that firsthand as an employee, you know, in contact with the manager. And then I started thinking about how that experience could be translated to the web. And just how, you know, schedules become like the traditionally schedule is a static artifact that sort of lives on the wall at the back of a business. How could that become collaborative? You know, what if a business could know why availability changes in advance and not assume that for the entire school semester, for example, that it stays the same? What if I could book the time off that I need to in advance? And then the things sort of evolve from there. But the initial spark definitely came from, you know, deeply understanding these businesses. And it was, again, this huge light bulb that went off the first time I started really thinking about kind of putting a business together about this, primarily just because it was like, I knew all of these different industries, and this is like a global problem. Like, shift-based business is a huge part of the labor force. And I just couldn't point to a single business that I'd worked at that used any sort of solution that was out there. And when I went online to, you know, see who's in employee scheduling software, there was a few players. A couple of them were pretty big at the time. But I noticed 2 things. One is that they were kind of niche orientated, predominantly in food and beverage or in healthcare. And then the other thing that I noticed is that this was sort of, Web 1.0, Web 2.0 or whatever, they sort of had these archaic products. There was nothing beautiful about them. There was nothing intuitive about them. Many of them didn't have mobile apps yet. So there was still, I felt like, a huge gap in the marketplace in terms of even just like what the existing competitors were there, and a wide open marketplace with literally millions of small businesses and big businesses that could use this thing.
And still, you told our producer that first version was really crude. It was almost like a clone of Google Calendar and social site.
That's right.
What do you mean? What could it do?
It did very basic things, especially at the beginning. And I think it absolutely was a clone. And I think a lot of the stuff that I did early on, I had no sense of kind of UI or UX design. So we would sort of go, you know, here's a project management site that we like, and that became our design, or Google Calendar was maybe a tool that people knew how to use.
Was Basecamp an inspiration? It feels a little bit like there's some in there.
In the early website, no, but there's another company called, Active Colab, I believe. That was one of the ones that was actually from Serbia. Okay. And so Humanity has a Serbian office there. So my designer that I met had, you know, was always referencing to that one. So
Okay. So you're just kind of copying what they did. How long did it take you to build the first version?
It took quite a while, actually, because it was the first time building a pretty dynamic user app, and there was a lot of sort of nuances in it, and none of the APIs that you have, you know, together now to like quickly send SMS and different things like that through Twilio. I would say it took 4 months to sort of build like the beta version of it, and then another 2 to 3 months to get something ready that was, I would say, like commercially ready in terms of having the website, the sign up process, and all of the rest of that ready.
Was this you creating it?
It was, yeah.
Wow. And so that you had, I kind of skipped over it, but you had a site before that was kind of WordPress, kind of MySpace, kind of like, or maybe like BuddyPress, where you allowed people to create their own social network / publishing site. It obviously didn't go anywhere. It got crushed by Facebook and WordPress, et cetera. But it seems like that's what helped you learn about software creation so that you could, you say this is a long time to me, 6 months doesn't seem like that long to create a first version of the software.
Yeah, I think I did have a number of these different projects and even, you know, client-based projects or things. There was already a lot of open source stuff that you could use, but not nearly. It's incredible what you can build now. I mean, you could do this in a fraction of that time today. Just with all the services and open source stuff that's available. But you're right. I think, you know, the first version of that, of shift planning of that software would have been like a fork of the code from the social network site. And then you start building on top of these user profiles and stuff. It all evolved together for sure.
Oh, that's great. Okay. And then you went out to get customers and you got a grand total of zero.
That's right. Yeah. Went online, kind of blew the horn and, you know, not a lot happened. I think it was sort of, again, the first time I was figuring out how to bring a SaaS business online. And so I did a number of things then that I did think ultimately set the company up for fantastic success. So I started thinking outside of the box in terms of, you know, what are different ways we can get customers in? And knowing that the product was a beta product, I decided to give it away for free.
If I understand this right, at first you had a partner. And with the partner, what you were doing was
trying
to get sales first. Who is this partner?
Yeah, so he was initially going to be a co-founder. And so the kind of initial understanding that we had is he would take over all of the commercial sides of the business. And I thought that was great. You know, what I want to do is build product. I want to code. That was the part that I love to do. And so I was happy to let him take that over. And what ended up happening is for better or for worse, trying to sell SaaS offline, I think, never really scaled or worked. But this was, you know, 11 years ago, trying to get companies to use a beta product of employee scheduling when most of them don't have a computer in their office or different things like that, that are doing, tablets, like point of sale based tablet stuff, all this stuff's everywhere now. It's like, why wouldn't you have this? But back then, that wasn't the case. And so we ended up going just looping in circles where every time he would go and meet a customer or a potential customer, and he would come back with another list of, you know, 10 features that needed to be built so that this one customer would try to use the product for free.
Why do you think that would be? Why do you think that because he would go into like the Olive Garden, he would go into places that had a lot of employees, a lot of time shifting problems. Why do you think that instead of saying no or yes, they would say, how about if you add this feature? If you had that feature, it would be great.
I think it was too early. I think it was honestly too early in the market from most perspective. And it's still like, it's honestly ironic. Like it's 10 years later, we've built a great business around this, solving this problem. 10 other people have built great businesses around solving this problem. It seems pretty obvious now that you should be doing this. It's incredible, you know, the large enterprises or, you know, hospitals and things that we deal with every single day still that don't really know these solutions exist. And so this was very much the case back then. Mm-hmm. Thinking about it deeper in terms of like, maybe why would they come back with a no, we're not ready. Or maybe that is the answer, where they're kind of giving excuses, because even when we could go back to them with the next set of things that they had asked for, they still weren't ready yet. And so maybe that was what it was.
Their excuse. It felt right, but something felt wrong. And they didn't know how to articulate that. Look, we don't have like a way to implement this. It's too intimidating. That's what it is.
I think so. Yeah.
And it's amazing, actually. Well, you tell me.
The other... The other thing that comes up, and I think this is something I always say with, doing, for example, like free trials and things like that, you're always trying to get to this like wow moment where an individual customer can see value. And when you're doing employee scheduling, it takes time to see the value in the process because you first have to implement the schedule you already have into the software. Then you have to get all of your staff onboarded. And it's only when all of those pieces come together that, for example, you see that two employees swap their shift, or you know that on Friday night, everybody showed up on time because everybody was aware because they got their SMS reminder beforehand. These are all things that you have to actually, do quite a bit before you start to feel that, wow, the benefit of having invested in the tool.
Right.
And so I think we weren't able at the time to demonstrate any of that benefit to them. And here we are asking them to change a key business process. And they're all busy. People that work in shift-based businesses, they work on the floor. So they're extremely busy. They don't really have the time to go sit down, get off the floor, get out of the restaurant for a while to go ahead and set up this stuff. And that's probably another big part of it. Just the friction was too big at that time.
Ryan, as you were describing the problem, I wondered if you were, and people in your shoes were experiencing the problem, but the person who would have to decide to implement new software wasn't experiencing it. They weren't riding back to the restaurant. They weren't asking somebody to shift time with them. They weren't then saying, hey, can I pay you to take my time, to take my shift so that I can go and, do this other thing. They didn't experience it. So maybe if they didn't experience a pain, they weren't ready yet to buy the solution.
Yep. I think that's right as well. And maybe if we had targeted back then, thinking about this problem now, if we had targeted different types of businesses that might've worked, because if I think back through what, some of the parallels were in our early customer profiles, they maybe were, owner run businesses. So the owner directly ran the problem directly, took out the credit card to solve the problem, which definitely helps. Absolutely.
So your partner, future co-founder, whatever the title was, just said, you know what, this is not working for me. He left. You said, all right, I'm on my own now. I'm a marketer. I got to find a way to market my own thing. And that's when you said, I'm going to take a radically different approach, which was?
Yeah. So the different approach was to basically, rather than trying to do anything offline, do complete like only online sales only. And I think the key thing that kind of helped us get some traction early on is I did a few things. One of them was I offered away the product for free at the start. So that brought in, early adopters. Some of those customers and users are still with us 10 years later, which was really fantastic. And then the other thing I did is I focused really hard on, the stuff that I had come from, which was internet marketing. And so we dominated the search engines, for the first kind of 3 to 5 years of the business for every employee scheduling, workforce management, all of these related keywords. And these aren't high volume terms. They've gotten bigger than they were 10 years ago, but it was to the point where you get this very high quality relevant traffic. And then I just focused on trying to build sort of a low touch marketing machine. So very low touch sales, really focusing hard on the product. And when you get that wheel moving, some pretty magical things happen because, if you focus on your product and your customers, they give you fantastic reviews, word of mouth spreads, all of that type of stuff. All the types of things that are very slow to get moving early on were the things that we were invested in. And so I think that helped build a fantastic, funnel for us very early on once that got moving. And it was slow, like you mentioned, for the first 6 months, there was no paying customers because I was giving things away for free. But fast forward to sort of year two and year three of the business, we were growing, 100%, 200%. Finally, 500% per year. And so things really, really got moving.
Yeah, I started looking at, I went to Google search results for shiftplanning.com and I limited it to your first year and then your second year. And what I noticed was there were a bunch of review sites, some of which I think are out of business. Others are like Inc. Magazine that would include you in a list. It feels like you guys were really good, or you personally were really good at that. Am I right?
Yeah. So again, I spent a lot of time on the review sites. And actually, if we talk about how review sites have changed the game now, it's fundamentally changed, where the review sites used to be a lot more about personal bloggers. And so I would go out, create a big list of everyone that was talking about anything to do with small business software, employee scheduling, all this stuff. And then I would go pitch them to include me in their list. And so that worked very well. I think that the way things are now, though, while I was focusing on, building organic rankings for our product, or like for our terms itself, Now, the way things have changed today is if you Google, for example, any category that we're in, like employee scheduling software, 6 out of the top 10 spots Google has reserved for the much larger review sites like Capterra, like Top 10 Reviews, like GetApp. And those are really big businesses. And so now there's a whole other game that gets played beneath the surface where you have to drive your customers to those sites to give you reviews. If you want to have a chance to rank them, you have to pay them money. It's fundamentally changed since the early days of the company.
Yeah, I don't think people are talking enough about how that works. That it, we all talk about, is Yelp hiding reviews from people who pay for ads, from restaurants who pay for ads? Are they playing that kind of game? Nobody talks about what Capterra is up to. Nobody talks about any of these sites. I've interviewed some of the founders. It's kind of interesting that what they try to do is be the neutral arbiter, but they get paid when you pick the right product. They get an affiliate commission.
I know. To me, it's something that, like you mentioned, it should be talked about. And in some ways, I think there's going to be an interesting scenario happening where I can understand why Google's sending their traffic to these sites, right? Like if you're Googling for a category term, not a branded term, then you're out there to discover the best sites. And so they want something that's engaging where it gives people a good review of that or a good lay of the landscape. But what's interesting is we know Google makes all of its money off ads. And so if, you know, these companies are spending less time going back in and out of Google for these types of searches and going to these third parties, and if they're not also clearly disclaiming whether, you know, how things are paid and not. And, you know, I know firsthand that a lot of this, the way that this stuff is done is, you know, a little bit shady and definitely not fully disclosed. But I agree. It's something that should get talked about more. And it's something we're going to keep seeing a lot more of, where there's sort of, well, like in everything we do, there's an algorithm that kind of hides a lot of the stuff behind it. So
I'm surprised that Google hasn't done to them what they did to Yelp, which is just copy the business and take it over and replace them in the search results. Maybe it's too small for them to focus on.
Might be too small, yeah.
So back then you were going after sites like, I see it, ebiztoolkit.com. I don't know if you recognize, you recognize them.
Not that one specifically, but there was like eBiz Online, or there's like all these types of things that, yeah, like you mentioned, most of them are not either around or...
they put a lot of effort into their site, and then you can see where they just stopped. Like this one specific case, the last featured product was Internet Fax, some product called Faxage. So this is the way that you were working. Suddenly you went from no traction, no results to, I think it was like the first month you got 5 users for free, and then some of them turned into, here we go. Traction was slow. 5 trial customers in the first month, 10 in the second month. It kept on growing though because of your internet marketing experience. Organic search was doing well. Product search was doing well. And then second year, things picked up. And I want to know why things picked up. But first, I'll talk about my second sponsor, and then we'll jump right into it. Wow, I kind of wish my second sponsor was HostGator so that I can ask you what websites to create today in the world as it is. Oh, you're smiling. Would you have some suggestions for websites to create today? Should we just shift it from TopTal to HostGator? You do. What would you create today? Let's riff on that for a bit, actually. We'll save it for later.
We can, but...
We'll save it for later in the interview if we have time. In fact, I'll just stick with TopTal since I teed them up already. Here's what TopTal is. It's a service where you can hire developers. If you or anyone else is looking for a developer, the way it'll work is you go to the URL I'm about to give you, you hit a button, you schedule a call. I asked Heaton Shaw, I said, Heaton, you've got one of the best networks out there in the startup world. He's a huge advisor for many people. He's friends with everyone in San Francisco, as far as I could tell. I go, dude, why are you going to TopTal? And instead of just tapping your network to hire a developer... And he said, it's the matcher. I said, what do you mean the matcher? He goes, as soon as you get on a call with them, the matcher will help you understand what you really need, shape that product, the job description, and then help you find the right person within their network who will fit that job description. So Heaton Shaw, who's founded multiple companies here and advised many companies here, uses them. So many other people who I've interviewed use them. Ryan should be using them. You, if you're listening to me, you've got to check them out. When you go to toptal.com/mixergy, what you're going to get is that same big button that Heaton Shaw pressed, but you're going to get a big advantage that he didn't get, which is 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period. That's toptal.com/mixergy, TOPTAL.com/MIXERGY, toptal.com/mixergy. What did you do after that? The first set of techniques worked for you? What was the next big thing that helped you grow?
I would say it was just continuing to do more of the same, honestly. There wasn't like a real, we started doing, you know, some different types of online ads and stuff like that, but the majority of our growth still came through organic. I think we really benefited from the trends that were happening in the marketplace. You know, just every single year in the last 10 years, there's just more and more online businesses or businesses, sorry, that recognize that you know, every part of their business or life is going to become SaaS, or the old vendors yeah. that they used to work with didn't offer the solutions or to the problems that they were looking for. And so I think that was one of the nice big things that this business has benefited from right on from the beginning.
One of the things that you did was you had inbound interest. People would come to your site, they'd see what it was about, they would ask for a demo, or they would kind of sign up for something. And then who was it who would call them up? What was your sales process when they did that?
Okay, yeah, we can, there's a number of different iterations. This was sort of a part of the business that, unlike, let's call it the online marketing side, which sort of stayed the same and we just kept kind of doubling down on what was working. The sales stuff was honestly kind of one of the wildest rides of my life, because I'd always built a business and I never enjoyed, I love talking to customers. I love getting their feedback. I loved onboarding. But I love the customer success element, you know, helping make them successful, fine-tuning the business and the product to something that made, you know, made them stay with us longer, et cetera. What I didn't enjoy was sales. And so from the very beginning, you know, I never wanted to sell or spend time talking to customers that were in early stage prospecting. And so the whole funnel was designed around really nurturing what is now a very standard client success model. So, you know, throughout the 30-day trial, we would do things like free accounts, you know, data entry. So we would load in their first schedule for them so they didn't have to do that. We would enter in, you know, the details for their staff profile. We would give them training until they were fully up and running on the system. And so that was something that worked, again, incredibly well. I think it paired with kind of more of our like product education strategy on the marketing side. And then somewhere along the way, we decided that we needed to do even better than that, or, you know, where we could try to start selling into cold leads. And sort of the whole company for a number of years really changed. Well, we really spun around in circles, doing everything from, you know, rather than having one client success rep, that would, you know, nurture a bucket of customers and do the best that they could. They sort of managed it like an order book. Things got very intense for a while where we had a team of, you know, 10 SDRs that were like immediately trying to call every single lead, but, you know, literally within minutes of the lead call coming in. So there's all these types of iterations.
Did that work for you? I know it worked for some companies.
No, yes and no. Yes and no. I think there's just so many better ways now to do, like with lead scoring and different things like that, that you can figure out and you can be a lot more efficient without having, you know, a 30-person dialing for dollars team, you know, manually nurturing leads. I think that type of stuff works maybe when you don't have as good of a product, or maybe your customers aren't as ready to, you know, self-discover and onboard or at an earlier stage in their buying cycle.
And so now how does it work?
It's very, very much like the original model. The few things that have changed, really the only thing that's changed is they've, just segmented and, you know, getting a lot smarter about lead scoring, and a lot smarter about segmenting leads, because predominantly as the business over the past couple of years, especially under the new CEO, is really focused on moving a lot more up into the enterprise. And so naturally these enterprise sales cycles are highly variable, but generally, you know, let's say 6 to 9 months long at least. And a lot of them start with, you know, maybe a 3 to 6 month pilot before they get to their full potential after the first year, for example. And so that's a completely different process than, you know, a small business with 50 employees that we know will close every 35 days, kind of like a turnkey business.
And even with these enterprise sales, it's someone coming in and trying out the software?
It still predominantly was up until about a year and a half ago. And then the other big thing that they've made is a shift really around focusing on enterprise level integrations. And so that's now where there's a very different deal cycle, you know, oftentimes with a partner like Workday, for example. And so that's where, you know, now we're starting to do trade shows again. You know, again, things that we would have never done 5 or 10 years ago, just because it's hard to go to a trade show and sign up small businesses.
Workday is like HR. Well, I'm on the site right now. It's, they do HR, financing, planning. It's the stuff that the E-level, the C-level,
that's right,
E-staff uses, right? The executives. And so they recommend you and they help implement it because of your partnership with them. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's right. So we've got a few partnerships like this. And so this is sort of an evolution in the business. I think like you mentioned right now, the business looks a lot the way it does today, actually, as it did, you know, maybe 8 years ago. They're really taking things back in many ways to our roots, where the goal is to be the dominant solution for employee scheduling, and recognizing that the game and the landscape is different when you start talking about workforce management. And so that was something that I was very passionate about, continuing to build out the product suite and do all these other things in workforce management. And depending on where you are in customer size, customers view tools differently, already using tools differently, and just the needs are very different. You know, trying to do HR at a restaurant of 30 people is completely different than doing HR, of course, at an enterprise with 10, 15, 30,000 people. And so for a small business, you can be their HR, their time and attendance tool when you're down there. But when you start moving up in the markets, they've already implemented a tool like Workday. And so the customers that start adopting us, they don't use us for any of those things. So just like HR and time and attendance is hard for businesses, employee scheduling is a very hard problem as well. And so what we found is that those customers that are using these enterprise SaaS tools haven't solved that part of the stack yet. And so it becomes a very different problem in where we're, you know, reading in employee data. We're no longer the system of record, for example, for employee data. We read that in, we schedule people, we ship out time clock back so they can.
Wow.
It becomes a different type of.
Okay. But it seems like a better customer because there's so many more people that you're serving and the dollar amounts go up higher. Before I go into a key issue in this transition, I've got to ask you, as I looked over earlier versions of your site and looked at like Google screenshots and so on, I saw at the bottom of your site a link to a screen sharing app called sbgrab.com. Why does this guy need that? I have some theories on why that was on your homepage, but I'd like to hear from you.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the things that was unique, I think, about our company, or at least my investors have told me that was unique, I could build product very quickly. And so we built all of our own internal tools from the get-go. I built my own help desk, our own recurring billing software, you know, all this types of stuff in our own internal stack. And one of the tools that we used actually for our help desk team was a screen grabbing software, so they could quickly take screen grabs of whatever, you know, customer they were looking at. In behind the scenes, it would upload it to, you know, an FTP server at the time, eventually to Amazon. And then it would, in your clipboard, automatically give you a link back. And so it just became this incredibly effective way to communicate over chat, because you could immediately take, you know, small screen grabs of what you were doing. And so that was a tool that we put out for free, just as sort of a, you know, way to bring back in links and stuff like that.
You made it for your team to have, and you said, you know what, let's just put it up on the site because other people could use it too.
That's right.
Yeah. You know what? I do notice that there's some teams that are really good at that. Like Zapier, if you ever send them a tech support question and they have a solution, they will not just do a screen grab. They'll even do a GIF to show you how to click on what you need to do. And that type of thing is really helpful. It's kind of interesting that this was also posted on Lifehacker back in 2010. And here's how much life has changed since 2010. I've scrolled to the bottom to see where they got this. They got it from Download Squad. And underneath that is a video of some dude showing me how to roll a joint. And I've had that up on my screen the whole time waiting to ask you this question. It's literally Lifehacker teaching you how to roll a joint.
There you go.
So the transition from one type of sales process to another involved you bringing in a VP of sales. You've said publicly, I think, or at least you said it to our producer, this was a wrong decision. Why? What happened?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a number of wrong hires that I made, and a number of kind of different tests that we tried. And I think generally my nature is to always, you know, move very fast, to test things very small, and always kind of be able to come back for them without having too much, you know, collateral damage, especially on the people part. Unfortunately, with what happens a couple of times in the sales team was just the culture went wrong, and it changed the dynamic of the company, where we changed from a company that was, you know, all about supporting customers to all about, you know, sales commissions and just trying to kind of make the month end. And so that changes all sorts of stuff that you don't really see at first. And so, for example, you ask, you know, does the month where 10 SDRs, did that help? We doubled the size of the team. You know, obviously our sales CAC is exponentially higher than it used to be. And so we did have a great couple of months there, but the reality was it looked great at first, but when you dug under the hood, we were selling all sorts of deals that were just not healthy, customers that were not ready, that were oversold on the solution. And so the type of turmoil that creates in your funnel after they've become a paying customer, then it falls on the client success team, the support team. I think some of the stuff that happened, unfortunately, you know, from what I've heard, sales always has a lot of shenanigans in it, and I've definitely been privy to enough of it. But I'm talking about the type of stuff where, you know, a sales rep is about maybe a few deals away from making month end, and so his girlfriend's in there entering in their credit card, like signing up for deals, and just sorts of stuff. Or you have, we had things like incorrect attribution, where, you know, you'd have a warm inbound lead that would then get associated as an outbound lead, because we also tried doing pure outbound calling for a while. And so that was, again, very messy. And so unfortunately, when I found out some of that stuff, I had to let a number of people go. There's just a lot of things that were unethical. And so I very extreme time. I was about to close a big funding round at the time with a tier one kind of San Francisco or Silicon Valley based VC. Just as I'm finding out that, you know, all of our sales metrics and a lot of the stuff's been fabricated for a while. So I took a bit of a reset then, and we sort of went back to some of these models that I knew worked.
Did you blame yourself? I'm looking for some vulnerability in you, because it seems so far like you're just super strong at everything. But I know that some of these decisions scarred you.
Yeah, they absolutely did. I think there was a couple of key things that happened in the company that did scar me. And I think that's part of the reason why I'm no longer with the company today, to be honest. It's just, it's hard. I've been reading about this recently, this idea of like the imposter syndrome. And it, for me, I kind of felt like that for a while, like, what am I doing here? I couldn't find a way to sort of get back from some of these mistakes that had either manifested in the company indirectly or directly. But as CEO, you definitely take all of the front for that.
And so how did you, well, you know what, instead of talking about how you got past it, let's go a little bit deeper into this. You also hired the wrong COO. You obviously have fixed this like issue, because the person who's now running the company, as far as I could tell, Chris Amani, he eventually became the COO of the business, and he grew into that role after taking on other roles in the business. But you did have a bad hire at COO, and that's one that scarred you. What happened there?
Yeah, so I'll share what I'm comfortable talking with. Yep. I brought, you know, there was, we had, I think at about, you know, midway into the, let's say my tenure there, I was there like 8 years. So after like 4 or 5 years, we recognized that for the company, I think to get to the next level, it was going to be necessary to bring in either a COO or a CEO. I was always very supportive of that. And I think, you know, looking back now, maybe I wish that we had looked a little bit harder for a CEO right out of the get-go, because I think it would have, well, I'll get to that in a second. But so we did. We searched for, about a year and a half. I think, you know, our recruiters called it one of the longest executive searches that they'd ever done. We tried a trial with someone actually on contract that didn't work out. Great guy. And then the another situation happened, and again, sort of just the culture of the company changed during that time. And I lost, I would say, in many ways, faith in myself. I started second guessing myself for just about everything that I kind of did as a person. And I just, it became really hard to operate in any way after that. And so I think with Chris, Chris is a very different profile. He's one of the fastest learners, smartest people I've ever met. And so, you know, I hired him for a finance role, and kind of every time there was an opportunity for something or he could help me with anything. And I think that's a great advice to anyone that wants to move up. You know, if you see your manager or your boss looking for help, or you think you can pitch in and do something, take on more responsibility to it. Yeah. That's a surefire way to a promotion. And so, but Chris is also a very different profile. You know, Chris brings a ton of broad experience, but primarily like in operational metrics, finance type stuff. And so I think we see each other very eye to eye in terms of like the cultural aspects of running a business. And there's just kind of like a very low key, you know, down to earth presence that maybe it's hard for me to explain, but that was sort of always the culture that I liked. I didn't like, you know, flashy people in suits. I didn't like people that were, you know, trying to play politics. Politics is one of like my least favorite things in companies, and actually the reason why I went out on my own in the first place.
And so how did you get past the imposter syndrome to accept this part of yourself and recover by bringing somebody in who wasn't just good at their COO role, but became a CEO too and allowed you to take some space? How did you get that comfort with yourself again?
You know what, to be honest, I don't think I'm fully over that.
Really?
Even the transition, this is something I've started reading books about this actually to try to self-help my health. Like there's this huge loss of identity when you spend 10 years of your life, literally around the clock building something. And then for me now, the transition was pretty fast out of the company, which was great.
Were you pushed out?
No, absolutely okay. Not.
Yeah, it was just you deciding it's time for me to go, and you're still working on yourself because it scarred you to that degree. Do you have a lot of friends outside of work, or has it all been you working in isolation?
It was a lot of working in isolation. And so I've got a lot of great friends through work, but like you mentioned, not a lot outside of that.
Wow. And
so that's one of the big reasons I'm looking actually very much forward to getting back to Canada. You know, I get a free group with all of my friends that speak the first native language.
I bet.
And so, yeah, there's a lot of parallels. But yeah, no, I think there's a transition that I'm still going through. I'm still trying to figure out a number of these things. So,
any good book on that that's helped you?
Nothing that I can point to that's been too game-changing. A good one that I liked was Finish Big. That one really talks about, you know, how you set the company up for the next growth, and that the entrepreneurial journey doesn't really exit until you fully landed and you have a new identity and something else.
Wow.
And so that one's interesting. But, you know, you asked the question, and I'm working on a different project now, and it's challenging. It's challenging because it's not the same. And so I'm still, you know, kind of refinding and discovering my identity while working on this new project. It's fun.
I'm kind of surprised that you would go into, you know, before we get to the new one, let's close it out with the branding for Humanity. I love the name Humanity. And
thank
it
you.
Feels so, I don't know. The last, I liked a lot your previous company name. For some reason, I can't think of it. I keep having to go back to my notes to look it up whenever I want to go back and do some research on it. It was more concrete. This is more expansive. Why did you do it? And talk about the challenges involved in the name, because it wasn't as easy as it seems.
That's right. It wasn't as easy. And I think that's because a lot of people have, you know, fairly powerful connections with the word already. Whether that's a lot of people say, oh, it's for a charity. We had people writing in like, it's a shame that you've used this for a business when it could be used for fundraising or something like that. And so, yeah, for me, I think I always approached business or a website, for example, from literally search engine optimization. Like, how could you get as many keywords into the name as possible? It's going to rank as high.
Right.
And that was really it. And then I think, you know, about 5 years ago, I did this exercise and we were talking about sort of what the vision for the company looked like. And, you know, if you think about SaaS companies, it is pretty still, it's hilarious. Like there's Zendesk, Freshdesk, like you can pivot around sort of between every SaaS business by changing either the root or the tail of the word. And in our space, it was no different. There was literally shiftplanner.com, there's shift planning, when to work, when I work, when to manage. Huh. So there was just nobody standing out that we felt from either a product or a brand perspective. And so we thought that this was one way that we could do that.
Okay. And then the difficulty was?
The difficulties are, so the difficulty in the brand itself, I think, was just really the idea of like the already existing ideas of what the name means to people.
Okay.
From that perspective. And so I think it was kind of polarizing at first. I think once we did it, everyone sort of understood, and that was a good part. Okay. The challenge is that the branding actually internally wasn't really just about the brand. It was really about kind of a new product and platform that we were working on at the time. And that was a big challenge. So we had really been working hard on moving, you know, much further beyond employee scheduling. And that's why, again, we wanted this brand that spoke not directly about the schedule and that really just spoke strongly about people, because we wanted to have a product that would be with an employee throughout their entire life cycle. And that, you know, kind of the pitch at the time was hire to retire. So
I like, by the way, that as we're talking, it's getting darker and darker. Thanks for spending this time with me. I can see it's evening where you are.
Let me turn on the light.
Oh, cool.
Sorry about that.
Let's talk then real quick with WorkChain. I get the idea. I'm wondering, where did you see a problem that you're looking to solve? Was there a problem where people wanted to get paid faster and companies wanted to pay their employees faster?
There is. So there's a few things that the idea for the product, by the way, came from my time at Humanity, working with, you know, the time and attendance space in particular. You start noticing these patterns where you've got all the data when people are you know, meant to be going to work, that you know immediately when they're going to go to work. And then also after a pay cycle happens, what they're actually getting paid for that. And so the idea started being, you know, can we offer this as the service? We've got all the data with high certainty that we could go ahead and even advance employees money before their employers actually paid them, knowing that they're going to get paid out, or we could even pull those funds back from the company. So this was a problem that we explored actually working on at Humanity. It was decided it you know, didn't align well with the focus on enterprise scheduling. And so that was the reason why I was able to go out and do this on its own. And the problem, the other big trend, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is really how quickly things are becoming, how fast things are moving to like these temp-based work, the gig and on-demand economy. These are big shifts in the labor market. And so now you have these scenarios where you've got individual contractors showing up, for example, for work, and they're incurring their own expenses to go ahead and cover for that shift, but maybe not getting paid until sometime afterwards. So those were the kind of like big trends. And then, you know, I can go into some detail on things, you know, stats about people working or living paycheck to paycheck. And a lot of people, unfortunately, have to go to very expensive and what I call predatory types of loans, oftentimes just because they need to make a medical expense or other things. And so we view this as a way to kind of fill that gap where we don't view it as actually lending any money to an individual. You're giving them the value that's already theirs and then recouping it later just because you can do that now with the data.
And that's the way it works? That you're taking the money out of your account and giving it to them, and then the employer gives it to you later?
We haven't launched that part of the product yet, but that is something that we will do. Part of the broader vision is actually to enable that as like a peer-to-peer fashion. So you can do
so
like
anyone could be a lender.
Anyone can be a lender on the platform.
Got it. Yeah, I see that. You guys have a great animation. Is this a GIF? I don't know what it is, but it's really well done in the middle of the workchain.io website, workchain.io.
Oh, thank you. Very talented designer there.
Yeah, you guys do a really good job of explaining this. I find a lot of times with crypto and Bitcoin and all that stuff, the explanations make it more complicated than it seemed when people went in looking for the explanation. So now that things are changing for cryptocurrency, for blockchain, how's it affecting you guys?
Things have affected us a lot, and we got kind of stuck in a hard spot because our connection got a little bit bad. Just let me know if you can still hear me.
Yeah.
Yep. So things change a lot. Like you mentioned, things used to be very technical. They used to be sort of all about protocols and all this stuff that honestly, when you dug into them, most of them technically didn't even make a lot of sense. And so what we really tried to do from the get-go was make something that was approachable. We wanted to build a real product that people could use. And that would sort of like democratize crypto or make it a little bit easier to get around with. And so like one of the misconceptions, for example, is around getting paid in crypto. Like, are you actually going to get paid then in Bitcoin, which is incredibly volatile? And when you go down to the shop, you know, the $100 you earned is going to be worth 80 or maybe 200. So what we're using are like, I would say it's more of like blockchain technology than anything else from that perspective. And so that enables us to, you know, do things like not have to go to the bank, you know, cut out the bank. We can do settlements for, you know, pennies or even micros of a penny at any time. So we call this money streaming, where you can literally, while a shift's happening, just have this steady stream of value that's been transferred from one individual to another. And so these are the types of things that are not possible using a traditional fiat system. It would just be inherently inexpensive, for example, or inefficient.
Because every time you transfer even a penny, there's a minimum cost that goes into the transaction.
That's right.
And with crypto, you don't have that. And that's what you're trying to do. And are people less interested in this now because of what's happening to the value of cryptocurrencies?
They are. They are. So there's sort of like, for us, we're really working hard to, I would say, pivot and make this more mainstream, where the conversation becomes more about, like, less about cryptocurrency first. That's sort of like an added benefit of what we can add. So that's a bit of a transition for us.
So where before it was cryptocurrency and blockchain emphasized in the website, now it's more about pay your people faster or get paid faster. And if you look under the hood, we're not hiding the fact that it's cryptocurrency. It's just not something we're going to put first out there.
That's right. I think, yeah, if you think back through the main hype, everyone, I think, thought very quickly that, you know, cryptocurrency and blockchain was going to take over the world and democratize everything, and there was going to be no banks and all this type of stuff.
Right.
And so people were buying into the, you know, that hype of the protocols and all this stuff taking over. And now it's like, okay, show me there's a real business. The people that are investing in this space are not investing, you know, predominantly in tokens anymore. They're going after equity, and they want to see all the same type of stuff, you know, as a traditional SaaS business, for example, would.
Do you feel like you've jumped too soon into this? I know we're at the end of the interview, but I've got to ask you, you're a guy who just has spent so many years of your life working hard. Do you feel like maybe you should have taken a year off, 6 months, a sabbatical like your dad did before getting into another company?
Yeah, I do. I do. I absolutely do. And, you know, to be honest, it wasn't my first dream to get back into running a company right away after just stepping down. And so I think that's, again, kind of part of the process I'm going through now. So I do. Yep. I would have preferred to have taken more time off, done some of the stuff that I get into, and yep.
But this felt like an urgent thing because no one had done it and this space was moving so fast.
That's right. Yeah. There was a huge element with the space in it. And then this was a product where it was a very different type of scenario. Like, this wasn't a lone soldier effort. I had the opportunity to work with a few of my, you know, very close friends that are very technically bright on this. And so it was a great opportunity to work with them directly as well.
Your co-founder is still working at his company too. Ivan is the creator of WorkPlus. Am I right?
WorkPulse. Yep.
WorkPulse, excuse me. Yeah. That tracks what people are doing on their computers when they're working for you. So you get a sense of how productive they are. He's still there too. But
he is. Yeah.
Wow. When do you go back to Canada?
I have like a week of just continuing to sell stuff, and then I'm back in, you know, 2 weeks max. I've never done this before. I've always moved and then sort of like set up and bought stuff. This is my first time selling stuff. So I'm trying to like balance still having a place to sleep before giving up my place and whatnot. So it's fun.
You know, there's nothing more liberating, I find, than just selling stuff and moving on, even getting rid of it. It feels so good.
Yeah. The blessing. So I'm in a shipping city, like with the canal here, of course. And it's been, I've called at least 10 companies and no one will ship even just a few boxes for us. So I'm literally, you know, after 10 years, my wife and I are just going home with a couple suitcases. Everything is gone. It is liberating. I'm going through all this stuff and literally half of it I haven't looked at or used in ever. So
I'm kind of glad for you that they won't, even though there's shippers everywhere. I'm kind of glad for you that they're not taking this stuff. There are a few things that you might want to keep as mementos of your experience there, but rest, start right. Fresh, let it go.
Even a lot of that stuff, I've just been taking pictures of it now, and everything is going to start afresh. So, yeah.
Oh, really? Even the most, like, what's a tough thing for you to get rid of now, but you know it's going to feel better later to not have it?
Honestly, the things that are the hardest stuff are the stuff that my daughter's given me. It's like, you know, a cup that she gave me for Father's Day or a painting that she made. And it's things that, you know, I would keep around my house, of course, if I had a place, but if I'm going to be traveling around Canada this summer, that's stuff that I'm not going to look at, and she'll forgive me. So I got pictures of a lot of stuff, and
I'm staying in the same place and I still feel that. I want to just take pictures of the stuff they give me. And I find that the photos are more accessible and they feel less weighty. There's less of delicacy, being delicate around it, around the house, worrying that it's not in the right place. You know, photo, yeah. We all have it. You share it. You talk about it. Hey, wait a minute. I get the photo. I just yell at Siri. Siri will bring it up. Wow. you know what? I could see your whole energy change, Ryan, as we're even talking about you moving to, back to Canada and you getting to travel more. Feels good.
I think so. Yeah. I appreciate
you doing this interview with me before you travel.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Letting me interrupt you like a million times. Sorry. I don't know what. I think it's a little bit of a lag and then it causes me to step all over you.
If I can ask you a question, what's the story with the beads on your mic?
I find that it helps me focus a lot. One of the things that I discovered was that my mind will wander to things that I don't want it to because someone will say something and they'll get it stuck in my head, or I'll worry about something and I'll just keep it on loop. And the stuff that I want, I don't focus on enough. And so as I traveled around the world, I noticed that a lot of cultures had different beads. Like this one's supposed to be more of a Hawaiian bead. And when my sister got married in Hawaii, she got the Hawaiian beads. They've got that. When you go to Arab countries, they've got the prayer beads. Catholic countries have it. But also South America people have it. And I said, you know, what if I just take one of these things and help me focus? So every time I would stay focused on what I want and what's true, I would move a bead and then focus on what's true and move a bead and so on. And it helped me. It helped me a lot. And so I still do it. Like even before running this last marathon, the doctor told me, look, there's a good chance your shin's going to crack here, but there's also a good chance it won't. Just pay attention to it. So yeah. All I kept thinking was shin's going to crack. What if I don't finish it? And I said, screw that. Finish. All I want is to finish healthy and I'm fine ducking out. If the last marathon wasn't going to work out, I'll find a way to repeat it. So I just moved the bead and said, finish healthy, finish healthy, finish healthy. I finished great. Finished great.
That's great.
You know what? Congrats. And it's possible that I would have broken my shin, but I don't want to have to thought about it the whole time. And God knows thinking about it the whole time leading up to the marathon would have led to a worse experience even on marathon day. So that's what it's about.
That's great.
Cool. Thanks for asking. If anyone wants to go see Ryan, don't leave him alone for a little bit. Give him some space. I feel he needs it. But you do have a personal site. I don't have it here in the zillion tabs that I have up on my site, on my screen. Don't you?
Yeah, like it's Ryan a little Fife. Bit outdated, but ryanfife.com.
Yep. I thought so, ryanfife.com. I appreciate you doing this interview and I appreciate the two sponsors who made, and Fife, I should say, is F-Y-F-E. And I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first, we'll do your email marketing right. And I hate that I just say email because they do so much more than that, but it's smart marketing automation. Go check them out at activecampaign.com/Mixergy. The second will help you hire right. It's called TopTal. Check them out at toptal.com/Mixergy. And let me know what you think about this this interview being edited. Our usual editor is out on maternity leave. Dan is doing this. Dan Gargon. I'm really interested to hear if the audio is coming across to you guys well. So let us all know. contact@mixergy.com. Tell my whole team. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Andrew.
Good night. Bye.